You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a half Michael Tuesday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Elizabeth Anderson on why our bosses control us. Freedom and the public sector, private government, and the reach of employers. Hello! I do that impression apropos of nothing to do with today's topic. Great interview that Sam just banked. We'll get to that. President Trump has canceled a trip to Latin America so he can convene on the Syria crisis. Chemical weapon attack that happened in eastern Ghouta on Saturday. Russia calling for a broader inquiry into the attack, even as they continue to play Turkey in the Kurdish region and jeopardize the one bright spot that has emerged from the slaughterhouse of Syria. Trump says he's going to decide on a response within 24 to 48 hours. Of course, Trump is a very calm and rational, chill man, so he wasn't distracted from any of this heavy decision-making about Syria by a FBI raid on his lawyer's offices. He wasn't distracted about it at all. Oh, no. Actually, it was reported that he was enraged and apoplectic, as there is more talk of firing the special counsel. Shocked that that actually hasn't happened already. Another associate is flipping on Paul Manafort. Sad. It's one of the only good things to come out of the 2018 election is that Paul Manafort might go to jail for life. And Mark Zuckerberg is set to testify to Congress. Will he sport a hoodie? Lula has reported to prison in Brazil as part of an ongoing soft coup in that country. And a former intelligence heavyweights have endorsed Trump's pick to head the CIA, Gina Haspel, who reportedly not only was part of the torture program, she personally engaged in it herself. And Mike Pompeo, he's a big-minded guy. He's reached out to Hillary Clinton to ask how to deal with a contentious confirmation battle. Nothing if not balls. I don't really know any. I mean,
it's bipartisanship.
I mean,
best.
I get that it's all in the game, but that really is something else. Giving that guy's political extremism and the fact that her boss still alludes to her going to jail. So yesterday, FBI agents raided Michael Cohen's offices, Trump's lawyer, in relation to payouts to Stormy Daniels. I think the threat is on that, as far as I understand. I have to be honest. I mean, when these things break, I realize just how much, and I think it's great. I mean, you know, anything that hurts Trump, and certainly anything that shoots up his cortisol levels, I'm fine with. But I'm not in resistance world, because I just don't, like, I don't even know what that was. I think it was in relation to Stormy Daniels.
But unless somebody has, like, a tape recorder in Mueller's office that can give us, like, the inside of how that's going, it's hard. I don't want to read the tea leaves on stuff. Like
right, exactly. Although I do.
The premise was bank fraud.
What, sorry?
They were
the bank fraud.
Yeah.
Because of, but in relation to the payout to Stormy.
Yes.
Right. Whatever happened to attorney-client privilege? Well, it's like, actually, your lawyers are not supposed to actively help you participate in fraud. What's the point of attorney-client privilege?
What's the point of lawyers?
What's the point of lawyers? That's what Dad said. Lawyers help you commit fraud. It's totally unfair. But here's two people who don't read things in a totally unfair way. Lou Dobbs and Sebastian Gorka with the lowdown on what happened yesterday.
Joining me now, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump, now a Fox Business national security analyst.
Looking just sort of terrifyingly boyish without glasses, like almost like a prepubescent wizard who's put some type of Harry Potter spell on himself so he can have a weird goatee. Go ahead.
Now a Fox Business national security analyst. Great to have you with us. The president has some tough choices to make about us, as usual. A host of events and issues, but Syria looms large, obviously, now, as he put it, over the next 24 to 48 hours, in which he says he'll make a decision.
Lou, first things first, it's truly remarkable everything this man has accomplished in 15 months, given the depths and the breadth of the swamp and the lies and the resistance to his agenda that we chose as the American people. Yeah. But now it's war, Lou. This is political warfare. What happened to lawyer-client privilege? What happened to the idea that you need a crime before you have a special prosecutor? These things have been thrown out the window, and now we have a fishing expedition that's turned into a witch hunt. So I'm glad the president has come out of the corner swinging, but when is the AG going to...
You wouldn't have expected anything else, would you?
No, but I want the AG to now withdraw his recusal and say this is out of bounds, this has nothing to do with your mandate, and Mueller has to be dealt with. He has to be fired, or he has to be asked, what are you investigating that has anything to do with Russia?
Let's go back to my question on Syria.
Okay, yeah, well, God knows. These guys have spared me from what happened next. But basically, what's funny about these clips is that the last two pieces are salient information, which is that obviously there's the ongoing rage, and Trump lashed out again at Sessions for recusing himself. So firing Mueller is back up in the top of the cycle here, and even the sort of indirect push to get Sessions to reverse himself on his recusal. So there's the actual meat there of some maneuvers you might see coming out of the Trump team. I like how Lou Dobbs is sort of like, hey, you're the biggest sycophant on the planet, but I mean, you almost implied like he wasn't always swinging there. Would you like to make sure that while he's watching this, he doesn't misinterpret that and freak out at you? And he's like, oh, of course I do. Of course he swings all the time. He also has the biggest penis on the planet, Lou. And I'm glad
he
that he's
turning over the...
No, you can do it.
And he is turning over the tables in the swamp.
And he's turning over the tables in the swamp, Lou. He's smacking people's faces with his well-endowed penis on behalf of America. And I think also regardless of your political inclinations, anytime a fishing expedition turns into a witch hunt, I think is a very disturbing thing. That was how Salem was founded. It was these people were fishing in lakes in Massachusetts, and then they were like, you know what, we're not getting what we want. Let's go burn a woman.
Why?
So that's which is exactly what's happening to Trump.
Why aren't the fish biting today? It must be a witch.
It must be a witch.
Some kind of a hex.
It's a hex. Robert Mueller's secretly a woman. I mean, the whole thing is crazy. Paging Jordan Peterson. See, in this job, all of this psychosis can start to merge into one blob. Ugh. All right, well, Sam's going to talk to Elizabeth Anderson about private government and why employers rule your life, and I'm going to go meditate. But before we do that, we have two very important messages for the Majority Report universe.
Hey, folks, you've heard me talk about Casper mattresses many, many times. I am now the owner of two Casper mattresses. One twin size? Is that the size, like the small size?
Yes.
Okay, once Saul sleeps on one, and I sleep on another, a queen-size mattress, ladies and gentlemen.
I also have a queen-size Casper.
Is that right?
That's right.
That's weird. We do not, let me just make it clear, we're not roommates. No. In fact, this is the first time I've ever met Matt. But Casper, as you know, is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. There are three Casper models. The original Casper, of which I am a proud owner of two. The Wave and the Essential. Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. I will also say this. I am extremely sensitive to being too hot. And the beauty about the Casper is that it's got a breathable design. It helps you sleep cool. It regulates your body temperature throughout the night. I never get too hot on my Casper mattress. The best part, it's delivered right to your door in a small, basically, how in the world is it in that box, package. It's free shipping and returns. U.S. and Canada. The best part is you can be sure of your purchase of a Casper mattress. And they were the first company, I don't know if they were the first company to ever do this, but I feel like they were the first company I ever heard that did this. 100 nights, risk-free. One-third of the year. Maybe not technically one-third. Like, it's like one quarter, more than one quarter of the year. You sleep on it, and if you don't like it, you send it back for free. You spend one-third of your life sleeping. You might as well make it count, folks. Get $50 toward the select mattresses by visiting casper.com/majority. Using majority at the checkout. That's coupon code majority. That's casper.com/majority. The offer code, again, majority. Get $50 off your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply. Believe me. You will never get a better night's sleep than that first night on your Casper mattress. And really, actually, the second and so on. But I'm saying relative to your old mattress. It's true for me. Also, very proud. Listen, I use all the products that we promote on this show. And we've had products where I'm like, it's not good. We're not doing it. And then there's products we just basically won't do. I was super psyched to get this ad. The New Yorker magazine. I mean, is there anybody listening to this program who has not read a piece in the New Yorker that has been blockbuster? It's an iconic magazine. It represents the best writing in America today. What I like about the New Yorker, and it is one of the few magazines that we get delivered in my household. Sometimes Nikki would get it. Sometimes I would get it. Because, A, I'm going to read something in there, and you know I'm addicted. I'm a political junkie. But I'm going to read a story that is super important for me to know. Whether it's, you know, Jane Mayer writing about whatever, the Koch brothers, or reading about OxyContin. But also stuff like Talk of the Town, and I get a chance to read short fiction. It's just amazing writing. You can inform yourself about the most current events and get insight from New Yorker's writers. Like I say, super entertaining content, the shouts and murmurs, the weekly humor, the satire, review of books, art, movies, TV, poetry, literature. You get four long-form feature stories. Who has not seen one of those cartoon captions? And have you never not done that? You've done that, right? At least once. Tried to come up with a caption for the cartoon?
I'm not very good at that sort of thing. I don't know why my creative abilities don't seem to apply. Yeah.
All right. You can even access, and this is what's also amazing, the complete archive, which has digital replicas of every issue of the print magazine from 1925 with your subscription. Don't wait. Go to www.newyorker.com/majority and receive 12 issues for $12. Is that serious? Plus a free tote bag. Wow. Enter my code MAJORITY, unlock 50% off your subscription. You get it delivered to your mailbox, inbox, or both by choosing between the print, digital, or a combination. Subscribe to The New Yorker and read something that means something. That's 12 issues for $6. Wait, for $6? No, for $12. Wait, $6? Is that really true? Wow. And a free tote bag when you go to newyorker.com/majority and enter my code majority at checkout. You got to do both. Go to newyorker.com/majority, enter code majority at checkout. All right, now back to Michael and the interview for the day.
They have cartoons and book reviews and it's the New Yorker. There's talk of the town.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. I got lost in a trance there. Now, check out, this is a very fascinating book, Elizabeth Anderson, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives. Sam just banked this, what was this, within the last couple of days, and then be back with me for the fun half.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Philosophy and Women's Studies at University of Michigan, Elizabeth Anderson, author of Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Okay, let's start with the concept that you introduce between public and private government. Tell us what the difference is and where the idea of a private government comes from.
Yes, so I want to stress the fact that contemporary American political discourse doesn't actually have a clear distinction between the public and the private, because we automatically assume that government is part of the public and the private sphere is something else altogether. And what I argue is that there is a lot of private government around. And what I mean by that is that if something is kept private from you, it means that it's none of your business. You don't have any standing to make claims with regard to that thing. It's somebody else's business. And so for a government to be private means that it's not the business of the governed to have any say or standing in how that government operates. So public government is a form of government in which the governed actually have a say and they have standing and they can insist that their interests be taken into account in any decisions of that government. Private government is some kind of oligarchy or a dictatorship where the governed, the people who have to take the orders, don't have any standing or authority to make claims on who rules them and what orders are given.
So is government in your usage, is it simply another way of saying authority, or is it, I mean, is it, I mean, is that basically what it comes down to? Is that an authority that one is subject to?
Well, any form of government would be an authority to which one is subject. But in a democratic form of government, the people can also hold office holders accountable. And so the people have a certain amount of authority. And it's precisely that makes government a public thing to the governed. And of course, it took hundreds of years of democratic struggle to make government a public thing. For most of human history, government was strictly the business of the rulers, and they claimed that it's their prerogative to make all decisions, and the people who were governed would just have to take orders and didn't have any authority themselves.
Is there a distinction within the context of businesses and, let's say, within the context of a dictatorship? I mean, if I'm living in a dictatorial society, I'm basically dealing with two separate private governments.
Well, yes, my basic claim is that the contemporary workplace is a form of government. Any organization where people's activities have to be coordinated according to rules amounts to a government. All kinds of private clubs and organizations have an internal governance structure. What makes that structure private is if the members of that private organization don't have any standing to make claims, they just have to follow orders. And so it's quite possible for a person to be subject to private government in the workplace and under the state. You could have a dictator at the state level and also be subject to your boss, who's a dictator, at work.
And let's talk about, I mean, and I think our audience is mostly familiar with the most egregious examples of this lack of participation in governance and where it can lead to. But I mean, tell us some of the most egregious examples of essentially worker abuse that takes place in the context of this. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, really.
Well, I think the most familiar form of worker abuse when workers are subject to private government is sexual harassment. And that's had gotten a lot of play recently. And I want to stress that sexual harassment is just one form of abuse that workers are commonly subject to. The one that I think gets people riled up the most because it's so shocking is that slaughterhouse workers in America who are dismembering chickens are not allowed to use the bathroom for the full 8-hour work shift. So they're told they have to show up in diapers. I've had even libertarian free marketeers feel outraged at this fact, but here we have hundreds of thousands of workers who can't even perform their basic bodily functions in a dignified way at grave cost, not only to their health, but to their ability to present themselves in a respectable way to others.
Okay, so with that essentially out there, so we have this, we're subject to this, I guess, private government relationship. Why? And you know, I've spent a lot of time over the years talking to libertarians. So let me pretend I'm a libertarian for a moment. Believe me, which is difficult. But why is this not simply a contractual agreement? In other words, you know, for libertarians that I have spoken to, the idea that the government, that their definition of government would be, I believe, having a monopoly of force. And why do you consider an employer to have a monopoly of force when it is a contractual agreement that the worker has entered into and ostensibly can walk away from? Nobody's forcing you, and an employer does not have the ability to force you to take this job.
That's quite right. So that's exactly what libertarians say. You have freedom of exit. You can quit whenever you like. So if exit rights were sufficient to make it the case that you are not subject to government, then if, you know, take a look at the European Union. You can exit any particular, if you're a citizen of the European Union, you can exit any particular state you like and enter any other state in the European Union freely. Does that mean you're no longer subject to government? I don't think so. And the same goes, suppose the communist East European bloc, when it still existed, allowed free movement between Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria and so forth. Would a libertarian say that the freedom of exit made it the case that people were no longer subject to dictatorship? I don't think so, because people's only choice was to enter another dictatorship. So I don't think exit rights cancel the existence of government. The reality is people need to eat, they need to work, they need a living. And in the United States, the vast majority of workplaces are dictatorships. The boss gives you the orders and you don't really have any standing to countermand those orders. You just have to obey them.
So, I mean, I guess a fundamental to there's two aspects of that argument, if I understand it. One is that it is too narrow a perspective to perceive only one specific employer. One has to look at the dynamic across society as all employers and all employees. And you cannot escape that dynamic, and that the substitute, I guess, or the surrogate for the monopoly of force is simply the human need to eat and have a place to sleep and theoretically, I guess, pay for your health care and whatnot. Like, those necessities end up being a source of, another distinct monopoly of force. Is that it?
That's part of the story, but there's another part of the story too that I think libertarians tend to neglect. And that is, if you ask why it is that the default constitution of the workplace is a dictatorship where the boss has all of the authority cards, you can't look to freedom of choice or the personal preferences of individuals in order to explain that. What really explains that is that the state, through its employment laws and its law of contracts and so forth, and corporate laws, has made it the case that the boss has all the authority cards. It's the state who's dealt the boss all those powers. And so why should a libertarian stand up for a distribution of power that was created by the state in the first place? They should be up in arms about it and care about the freedom of workers.
Right. And we obviously have all sorts of laws that constrain unions and, like you say, a whole host of employment laws that fundamentally define the relationship between the employer and the employee. And I suppose you could even take it to the point of, I want to circle back on that, because I know that is part of your suite of solutions. But so let's, once we recognize the notion that there is a private government that we are subject to, let's go back and trace the sort of the development of this notion. I mean, you returned to Adam Smith and to Thomas Paine and Abraham Lincoln, for that matter, and explain in your book how their ideas were, I mean, I guess on some level, you could either say misinterpreted, or the essence of their ideas was misinterpreted, or they were not properly reinterpreted for a new context. So let's just start with what Adam Smith and Thomas Paine et al. were arguing in their what were their moral motivations for promoting a free market?
Yes. So the original free market thinkers thought that free markets would actually deliver emancipation to ordinary workers, because on their theory, if you have open competition and abolish monopoly, the most efficient producer is going to be a self-employed person who works his own capital that he owns himself. Under that system, everyone will be self-employed. Everyone will be their own boss. And so all workers will be completely and fully free because they don't have to obey any orders that they haven't given themselves. That was a picture that made certain amount of sense theoretically before the advent of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, will you explain the context in which they developed those ideas? Like, what were the the existing circumstances in which they were attempting to, reform in some way.
Yeah. So if you look at Tom Paine, who I think gives us the clearest case of advancing this idea of universal self-employment as a plausible idea, he's writing at the time of the American Revolution. He's a great revolutionary hero. And the United States or the 13 colonies at the time of the revolution had pretty much the highest rate of self-employment among free workers anywhere in the world. Paine, of course, was anti-slavery. He wanted to get rid of slavery. And everyone thought at that time that slavery was economically doomed as a system of production. So imagine that the slaves are free and you have all this land available that people can set up their own farms, or they could just set up their own craft jobs. America came as close as you could imagine at the time of the revolution to a system in which everyone either was self-employed or had a reasonable prospect of becoming self-employed as soon as you get rid of the horrors of slavery and a few other oppressive laws and abolish all monopolies and make sure that there's open competition for everyone. And that vision was also Smith's vision. He was also strongly anti-slavery. He wanted to break up the monopoly of land. There were a few hundred families in Britain that locked up all the land in estates and had inheritance laws that made it illegal to break up those estates and sell them in small pieces. So yeoman farmers were shut out of the land market. Smith said, get rid of those laws, and then these inefficiently run large estates would be broken up and yeoman farmers would buy their own farms and operate them more efficiently and productively than the lazy landlords. And you'd have a system in which people are by and large self-employed.
Go a little further for us, if you could, in terms of describing the monopoly dynamics. So there were basically large landowners from Britain. What other forms of monopolies did we see there? And what was the argument against these monopolies simply about efficiency, or was there also this sort of same dynamic? I think you would probably argue that Paine was making almost the same argument that you are making now. It was just in a different context. But speak to that monopolies, because there is a reoccurring theme, at least we're seeing in parts of the left today, where monopolies are coming back into focus as being problematic. And we've interviewed a lot of people who are on this program who are actively, attempting to return to a pre-Robert Borkian period of understanding of monopolies. But give us a sense of what the understanding of monopolies were when Paine has that problem with it. Is it simply just a question of efficiency, or is there also other issues that they see with monopolies? And what other forms of monopolies were there?
Yes. So back in the days of Adam Smith and Tom Paine, and even before then, most corporations, when they obtained a charter from the state, would get a monopoly. They'd get monopoly rights. So you would have a monopoly on the sale of, certain wares, or the import and export of china or something like that. And then other competitors wouldn't be able to do business in that line of operations. You also had, even earlier than Smith, a guild system, which was basically run by the large craftsmen in any particular craft, such as, goldsmithing or candle making. And the large craftsmen would prescribe hours in which people could do business in particular places where they were allowed to sell. They called all the shots, and small craftsmen were completely shut out of any ability to control this. They were just totally dominated by the large the large owners. And basically, I'm really glad that you mention that the case of monopoly has been put back on the political agenda. I think it's absolutely critical because monopolies aren't just economically inefficient. They also operate to oppress not only customers, but workers. It's really important that a lot of the declining economic prospects, as well as the declining freedom of workers, can be tied to the increasing concentration of many industries and the lack of available alternatives for workers to find work. So it's important to stress that workers are not only deprived of material benefits under monopoly, but they're also subject to a more oppressive form of government. They have less freedom because where else are they going to go? Right? They don't have many options.
And so they have this perspective of Payne has this perspective of individuals setting up their own business, being free of the, in many respects, the tyranny of government, be it private or public, in this respect. And but yet, at one point, it becomes clear that the sort of, I guess, the vestige of what they are advocating is all that remains and not the undercurrent, the undercurrent or the motivation behind it, right, as we move into the industrial revolution.
Yeah, so I think what happened was that the Industrial Revolution did something fundamental to dislodge the original free market vision. So that original vision was based on the idea that economies of scale were negligible, that really what determined the size of the enterprise would be people's incentives. And people have the most incentive to work hard and efficiently when they own their own business, because then they get to keep 100% of the fruits of their labor. That was the old argument, but with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, economies of scale just became overwhelming. Workers end up working huge concentrations of capital. Think of railroads or steel mills, right? It takes lots and lots of people to operate such things. And today, you know, you have hospitals and, you know, universities are just huge. They require hundreds of people to run. And so once that became the reality, then the ideal of individual self-employment, everyone just owning their own shop or business or farm, no longer made any sense. And so egalitarians, people who wanted to work for the freedom and equality of ordinary workers, at that point moved into socialist modes of thought, where they're thinking about, well, how can we secure collective freedom in organizations where people have to be working together? And so various forms of syndicalism and ideas of workers' cooperatives and so forth arose. Whereas the free marketeers, right, they didn't really keep up with the changing reality. They never really came up with a plan B for workers. And so some of them just accepted private government at work, and they ended up endorsing a very harsh and oppressive system of factory employment. And we know what happened to workers under that system. And other free marketeers, many of whom we see today, continue the old pre-industrial revolution rhetoric of people like Payne, and imagine that workers are free under the current system when in fact they're subject to dictatorship at work. And that's what I'm trying to expose, is that there's a kind of ideological obfuscation in free market rhetoric today that fails to recognize the subjection of workers under private government at the workplace as a problem for workers that needs to be addressed.
And it's almost as if that that vestige of the ideology atrophied too. I mean, because when you look at like someone like Payne, he was also, you know, contrary to, I think, what how libertarians would perceive him today. I'm talking about American libertarians, and I know there's a lot of libertarians get very upset when you miscategorize them in some ways. But that he was in favor. In fact, I think proposed basically the functional equivalent of a Social Security system. You know, both in terms of disability, which is, you know, not exactly a libertarian construct. I mean, that gives a clue as to what the essence of his proposals were, and it's almost as if like the shell of it atrophied and did not develop with these changing times. And so the so if the Industrial Revolution changed it, and what is that? Why? I mean, was it a failure of adjusting to the Industrial Revolution? Was it that industrialists, you know, sort of invested in making, you know, obscuring that change in dynamic? What, why has that been so obscured?
That's a really great question. And one way to think about it is that prior to the Industrial Revolution, the model of the worker that the free marketeers had in mind was somebody who owned their own capital, right? It would be the yeoman farmer who owns his own farm, but he's also working it with his hands. Or it would be a small craftsman who is manufacturing objects on a small scale for sale, and he owns his own shop. These are very small businesses. The Industrial Revolution pretty much wiped out the small craftsman. And as we know, with the development of railroads, right, the small farmer also pretty much got wiped out. And now farms today are on an immense scale, and you have far fewer farmers than you had before. And so if you have an ideology that was originally designed to vindicate the claims of the self-employed worker, who was conceived ultimately as all workers could achieve this status, after the Industrial Revolution, you have a kind of split, which reflects the fact that workers and owners became separate classes of people, whereas before they were imagined to be the same people, both working and owning at the same time. And so when the people split into two different classes, it's a genuine question where the ideology was going to go, an ideology originally invented for a class of people that no longer exists, the worker owners. There is only a tiny number of people who occupy that class. And so some of the free marketeers decided to side with the owners. And most of the people who were sympathetic to the workers moved into a more socialist orientation because they realized that most workers would have no chance really of owning their own enterprise.
And I mean, in some ways, if this takes place, you know, in the through the late 1800s and early 1900s, this shift, I mean, it seems like we began to see the ascendance of those who had assembled on the worker side, and those fortunes reverse as we get into the 50s and then the 60s and then, you know, in the 70s. It has completely flipped, it seems.
Yeah. So you do see socialist workers movements made real gains from the late 19th century, really through the first couple of decades after the end of World War II. There was very strong union movements, much more so in Europe than in the United States. But even in the United States, labor unions gained hugely all the way through World War II, and for some time after, they were pretty stable. In Europe, we see a very interesting development that took place mostly after World War II, which is that workers actually gained a voice in the government of the workplace. In Germany and in France and some other wealthy European countries, workers, even today, have a right to a voice in the workplace, to actually join management and jointly operate the firm along with representatives of the owners. We don't have anything like that in the United States.
And so we should say this is government mandated. This is not by the benevolence or even via a negotiation. This is government mandated that they are part of that ownership.
Part of the management. That is correct. Yeah. Yes, it's all part of employment law that workers get this right in enterprises of 50 or more employees. The really tiny shops, they don't really have this, but the larger enterprises, workers have a voice in the government of the workplace in many European countries.
And we should say that while union density, I think, continued to increase through the 50s, like Taft-Hartley was sort of that in some ways maybe, you know, may have turned out to be that sort of that, and I maybe not maybe, I think was that sort of the delayed kidney punch. That doesn't show up until, I don't know, like whatever it was, Bruce Lee would do the kidney punch.
Taft-Hartley, I think, was 1948.
Yes.
So already, yeah, late 40s, you already see a turn against labor unions in the United States, and they start losing power, but they're still pretty powerful through the 70s.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are the solutions that you see, and maybe I should just put a pin into the question as to why not, if the original intent of Paine was a conceiving of worker owners, why not return to that as a solution now, like cooperatives as a as a potential solution? We spoke to Professor Richard Wolff on this program several weeks ago, and his proposal is to have at least the opportunity where businesses that are looking to sell or to divest in some fashion, have the opportunity to sell to their workers, and the government finances that. Why is that not the solution, or is it part of your solution set?
Yeah, so workers cooperatives, when you can get them, are a potentially attractive model for securing the freedom of workers at work. But there are several difficulties with that. One is that in the standard case, workers simply don't have the capital to buy out these enterprises. So that's like a big problem. How are they going to come up with the money? A second problem is that it's not necessarily all that prudent to put all of your eggs in one basket. So if you put all of your savings and you depend on your job in the same enterprise, what happens if technology shifts and you go out of business because you're no longer running a viable operation?
Right.
Or taste shift and so forth. Seems very risky and imprudent for a lot of workers to do that. And that's why I'm looking to things like co-determination, which is what they call joint worker owner management of firms, as an alternative that will secure a voice for workers in the workplace without requiring them to put up all the capital, which seems beyond reach for most workers. I just think it seems more within reach than workers cooperatives, but where you can get a workers cooperative, that's great.
Right. Okay. So a co-determination is one element of a policy prescription. And tell us what the other ideas that you have that are inhibiting, I guess, workers' rights and well-being, and I guess wages and conditions in the workplace.
Yes. So another thing that needs to be done is to enhance workers' exit rights. It can be very costly for workers to quit work, and employers are bending over backwards to make it ever more difficult and costly for workers to quit their employer. So we have a proliferation of non-compete agreements, which means that if you quit a particular employer, you're not allowed to take your talents and skills with you, because you're not allowed to exercise those talents and skills under the employment of a competitor in the same industry. So people get locked into a particular employer because they'd be banned for a certain number of years if they try to move to a competing employer. Another thing that really needs to be done, besides the abolition of non-compete agreements, which I think are totally not necessary to secure anything of interest. California bans non-compete agreements, and California is the very center of high-tech innovation in the world. So if California can flourish without non-competes, I think every place in the world can flourish without them. But I think also focusing on antitrust would also be really important. If there are so few employers that they don't really have to compete for workers, then they're going to feel entitled not only to deprive workers of decent wages and benefits, but also to oppress them at work and abuse them, because workers really don't have many alternatives. So antitrust is a really important thing to do to enhance workers' freedom at work.
And I mean, non-compete contracts have always struck me as being just, I don't even understand how they're frankly legal, to be honest with you. I mean, it seems to be to sort of like to prevent someone from working after the fact seems to me to be, you know, essentially signing up for indentured servitude, which is also not, you cannot in this country enter a contract like that. It is just simply not enforceable. But all right, but be that as it may, because obviously the nature of our Supreme Court, and I don't mean just this Republican one, but the nature of our Supreme Court has not been terribly kind to workers in that respect. But non-compete seems to me to deal with a specific class of workers. But what of like low wage workers? Are there protections that you would prescribe that focus more on folks who are perhaps maybe less, I don't want to say less skilled, but have less unique skill sets?
Well, I just want to stress that non-compete agreements have proliferated so much that even low-skill workers are subject to them. Mm. So Jimmy John's, the sandwich shop, imposed a non-compete agreement on its workers, claiming you can't go over to Subway because you'd be, competing. It's like crazy.
That's
absurd. We have summer camps that have told summer camp counselors that they can't be a counselor at a different summer camp. So these agreements actually have spread very deep into the low-wage work sector, and they're all designed to trap and intimidate workers.
But are there other, I mean, aside from prescriptions that, I mean, obviously you call for increase in union, in making it easier to unionize.
Yes, I think unions are incredibly important vehicles for vindicating workers' rights. And I would advocate a system in which organizing was a lot easier. We should move to a card check system rather than an election system. If you persuade people to sign a card saying they want to be represented by a union, that should be enough. Under the current system, where a card check only secures the right to an election, then the employer can get in there and frighten and intimidate workers who before the election, and tell them he's going to shut down the shop if they vote in a union, or they're going to get fired. This is all illegal, but it happens routinely. The election process also exposes the workers who are organizing others to being fired. Again, that's completely illegal, but it's routinely done. I think we got to get rid of the election system and just have card check. and then have serious sanctions on employers who refuse to bargain in good faith and reach a quick contract with the union. Because the other tactic that's used to destroy labor unions is the employer just refuses to bargain with them, and then the workers get sick of paying dues when they don't see a better contract delivered to them, and they could be waiting for years to get recognition. So all these abuses, I think we have to really tighten up and strengthen labor law so that unions actually have the power.
And you also talk about at-will contracts.
Yes. So employment at will is one of those double-edged swords. Of course, workers want the right to freely exit the workplace. It's a very important right for them. But it also means that the employer can fire them for any or no reason at all. And in fact, it's employment at will that is the foundation of the employer's dictatorial power over the employees. Because if you can fire a worker for any or no reason, you can fire the worker for all kinds of reasons that are totally irrelevant to how well they're working while they're at work. And there are many cases where workers have invaded the privacy of workers and fired them because of their choice of domestic partner or their sexual activity off hours, their recreational activity off hours, all kinds of stuff that they're doing not while at work, but off work. So I think we need to strengthen workers' privacy protections, their freedom of speech, their freedom to choose recreational activities while they're not at work, and so forth. And so that they can't be fired because, say, they supported a political candidate who the boss doesn't like. It's really none of the boss's business who the workers support in their political activity. But right now, the laws are very weak and don't really protect workers against being fired because they vote or contribute to the political campaign of a candidate that the boss doesn't like.
And so, I mean, I think it's very hard for Americans to even imagine a system where there are more protections for someone's job or their, to inhibit the ability of an employer from firing them. I mean, where do we see examples of like that in Europe and other countries?
Yeah, well, European workers have all kinds of rights that American workers don't enjoy. But if they knew that they could get those rights, I bet they would want them. So, for instance, in many countries of Europe, we have things that are known as anti-mobbing laws. So under the United States, it's technically illegal for a boss to engage in sexual harassment against a worker. But that's only if the boss is not an equal opportunity sexual harasser. If he just harasses everyone equally, regardless of race or gender, it's legal. Whereas under anti-mobbing laws, nobody is allowed to bully anybody in the workplace. Any kind of harassment or bullying, whether it's by the boss or by fellow workers, is illegal. And workers have a claim against all kinds of abuse coming from anywhere at work. I think a lot of workers in America would really appreciate having the freedom to go to work without getting abused, humiliated, and bullied.
Yeah, that's not hard to imagine, but it is sort of shocking that we live in that kind of system. Elizabeth Anderson, the book is Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Great talking to you, Sam.
Back. Hey, folks. All right. So that was Elizabeth Anderson, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives. We're going to go to the fun half, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Of course, Sam is in Vegas. So tomorrow, it's me. We're talking with Alex Huckley on the ground from Sao Paulo in Brazil. We're going to get deep into that, and I'll touch on that in the fun half as well. That's really one of the most important things happening in the world today. So we'll get to that. Become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show survives. That's how the show grows. It's over 90% you. Leave Majority Report a review on iTunes. that keeps us good in the charts and helps people discover the show, as does subscribing. What are we at on YouTube now? We've cracked. I mean, we're well over.
We cracked 250,000 on YouTube.
Very nice. And so
we are coming up on some of our competitors. More and more people are noticing.
More and more people are noticing.
Zoom right past them.
I appreciate that because I just checked myself from making a joke, and you sort of basically went into the area that I wanted to go that I had restricted myself from. And the reason I restricted myself from a joke was not because I'm maturing from those sort of cheap shots, but because I had multiple angles of different people that I wanted to take indirect pot shots at, and I didn't know who, so I just stopped.
All sorts of haters.
Cosa Nostra. It's the Majority Report. So those are all the ways, you know, keep spreading the word. Tonight on TMBS, 7 p.m., talking with Doug Lane. He's the publisher of Zero Books. We're talking about science fiction and socialism. He has a new novel out. It's an interesting conversation. Then Gene Bajelan, who's crew, regular contributor on the Michael Brooks Show. He's in studio, and we're going to be talking about what's happening in Afrin, Rojava, as well as Gaza, and understanding the context of the anti-Semitism conversation around Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. And we are now past, 1,200 patrons, and there's a ton at this point in terms of illicit histories and postgames, just a massive amount of full content. So patreon.com/TMBS. Check out Jamie Peck Patreon as well as Antifada. And we will see you in the fun half.
I was simply trying to fix the culture in many ways.
And he is turning over the tables in the swamp.
So-called progressives are actually regressive.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
To help with connectivity.
Just make sure you do it well and you do it with passion.
Please don't try to talk over me, which is what liberals do.
And what is Aleppo?
You have been the Edward R. Murrow of this whole process.